Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you may know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. She's undergoing aggressive treatment, and her attitude is stunningly positive. Please keep Susan in your thoughts and prayers. If you'd like to keep up with how she's doing, visit her website at www.conqueringcancer.me. That's www.conqueringcancer.me. You'll be able to read Susan's blogs, send her messages of support, and learn what you can do to help. In Susan's absence tonight, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, is manning the switchboard and filling in. Organized crime was in the news last week with the passing of former Lucchese crime family associate Henry Hill. The hit 1990 movie Goodfellas was based on Henry's life. Tonight we're going to talk about Henry and government witnesses in general and the Federal Witness Protection Program and other mob-related topics with a guest with organized crime expertise. And joining me tonight is Andrew DiDonato, former Gambino crime family associate and author of Surviving the Mob. Jack Falcone, who was scheduled to be on, also ran into a last-minute conflict and is unable to make it. Andrew, welcome to CrimeWire.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, Dennis. Glad to be here. How's everybody doing tonight?
I'm fine. And Kim?
I'm excellent. Looking forward to the show.
Andrew, let's start off talking a little bit. I don't want to make the whole show about Henry, but Henry was in the, or the, actually Henry's passing was in the news last week. And Henry, his name really became famous as a result of that 1990 movie, Goodfellas. It was in which Ray Liotta played Henry. And if when I've talked to Henry in person, he told me that movie was almost spot on accurate. So based on that, I'll be referring to that movie or scenes from that movie regarding Henry. First of all, now and you correct me if I'm wrong, please. Henry could never have become a made man because of his ethnic background, right? He was not Italian.
Well, he was Italian. Now, I believe Henry's mother was Italian.
Was that enough?
Yeah. Well, you know what? In today's day and age, it would have been enough for Henry. But years ago, when they were more stringent with the old time rules from Italy and everything like that, brought it to the United States, they pretty much followed that protocol. But, you know, as, you know, the generations passed on, and, you know, a lot of guys broke the rules over the years when they married someone who wasn't, you know, full-blooded Italian. I mean, John Gotti's son wasn't full-blooded Italian. He got made. I mean, you know, and it all depends on, you know, what kind of stature you have within the crime family or whatever. I mean, Henry Hill would have definitely been made, and it had it been this day and age for sure, without a doubt.
Okay, but back in the 60s and so forth, they were a little bit tougher on the requirements, right?
Well, yeah, they were a little bit tough, you know, because you had a lot more old school guys back then. Guys were still traditional. You had a lot of traditional mob guys back then. Then it started to change a little bit afterwards. But I guess back then when Henry was up and coming, you know, they looked at it with a different view. But Henry still got the respect that he needed to get by and do what he had to do. I mean, he was well respected. He did what he had to do when he was in the street. And that crew that he was with was actually from my neighborhood. Those guys were real, you know, they had a real solid crew back then. And Paulie Vario from Canarsie Paulie Vario was a legend in my neighborhood. I mean, so, you know, he was with some real top dogs back then.
And the that Jimmy Conway, or the character that De Niro, Robert De Niro, played in the movie, he was, I guess, a real dangerous dude. Am I correct?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, that wasn't his real name. Of course, they changed it for the movie. And
yeah.
The guy that it portrayed was, you know, he was a notorious figure. You know, he was an Irishman. His nickname was Jimmy the Gent. He was a gentleman
okay.
guy. You know, everybody liked him, and he was a big earner. And you know, they were strong, those guys. They were strong back then. They really were.
And Henry told me one time that Pesci's character, I asked him, I said, did they overdo that with the violence in the movie? He said, no, he said, these guys were like that.
Well, you know what? You know what the thing is that, you know, some guys are big earners. Other guys, they get through the ranks by violence, you know, and it just so happens that, you know, Pesci's character was based on a guy who looked to be more violent than, you know, the average guy. You know, Henry, when you look at Henry's character, Henry was pretty much all-purpose guy, but he looked like he was more of the earner out of the two of them. You know, Henry was more of the earner, it seemed, you know, from what I got from the movie, you know.
Right.
And I just like to say it's very sad when I heard about Henry, you know, Henry pretty much paved the way for guys like me, Dennis, you know, who changed our lives, who, you know, wanted to reveal what organized crime was truly about. I mean, Henry, when you really think about it, you got to give him that respect. I mean, you know, I spoke about it. I was talking to Billy Cotola the other day. We were speaking about it. You got to give him that respect. He opened the door for us. He really did.
And what? And I was going to say, and where Henry, now, had Henry not ended up becoming a government witness, which actually was the catalyst for the movie. I mean, that was the whole thing about what happened with him and how he ended up becoming a government witness. He probably certainly wouldn't have had the notoriety because, you know, I mean, there are a lot of – if he had just been arrested with the rest of them and so forth and gone to prison, he wouldn't have got the notoriety he received because of turning government witness and then testifying and –
That's what organized crime is, Dennis. They don't realize that so many guys, and this, you know, so many guys, no matter what position they were in, whether associate, whether they're made guys, captains, whatever, there's so many guys, like from our neighborhoods back then, because, you know, that was still my neighborhood. You know, even myself, we all threw our lives away trying to be a part of this. And, you know, there's a lot of guys out there who were really, really, you know, they were loyal guys. They were out in the street, you know, they were doing what they had to do. They were doing the dirty work and everything. And, no, they never got none of those, accolades or anything for, you know, being a good friend to other guys or whatever. And you know what? They went to jail and nobody ever knew who they were, or they died of natural causes or even were murdered. And nobody really, you know, looked twice about it. You know, Henry's cases, you know, it's a lot different, you know. And that was the road that Henry went. Henry seen the writing on the wall. He made his decisions to change his life. And now, of course, he got the notoriety because he exposed it for what it really was. And you know what? And rightfully so.
And, you know, Andrew, something that as a non-insider of the mob, I was never involved with the crew or anything, so I don't have that insider knowledge. And most of my life as an outsider, when I heard the term informant, okay, I kind of just lumped anybody who testified on behalf of the government or provided information to the government under that umbrella as an informant.
Yeah.
But of the last several years, since I met you and met Henry and Frank Collada and Billy Cotola, I met several people, and I have come to a little different opinion now. And I'm going to tell you what I think. I'd like Kim to voice her opinion, then we'd like you to tell us what you think. What I've found, and Frank Collada, actually, for those who don't know him, he was a former Chicago outfit crime family associate. Frank made it clear to me when we talked that he was not an informant. He was a cooperating government witness. And like I say, at that time, I didn't really, I I just used the term informant or the word informant. And Frank explained to me his opinion. And he said, look, he said, the reason I turned, or flipped as they call it, and became a government witness, he said, is because the mob, in this case the Chicago outfit, he says, was going to have me whacked. They were going to have him killed. And he knew it. The FBI had obtained wiretaps of the authorization and so forth. And when Frank was confronted with that, he said, and they never asked me, and I never would have, he said, like, you know, taking a wire, say, okay, we're going to let you out of jail now. You wear this wire for us and go talk to this guy and that guy and this guy. He said, that never came down. He said, I wouldn't have done it. He said, what I did, though, he said, because there were no choices. They were going to kill me. He said, I made a deal with the government to cooperate with them, and it was all based on my honesty, so I couldn't make stuff up. He said, if they caught me in a lie, I was toast. He said, but to become a cooperating witness. And in Frank's opinion, an informant is the guy who wears the wire, basically works his way into a crew or with certain people, tries to get them to say things on the wire, and then turns the evidence over. Or a guy who maybe has been busted and he's looking at jail time, maybe some serious jail time. His life is not threatened by his associates. It's just a matter that he's facing some time behind bars and decides he doesn't want to do it, and he or his attorney approaches prosecutors and say, hey, look, we're willing to give up, you know, a certain number of people or some people here in return for either a pass or a minimal disposition on the sentencing. So I see it as different types of people who become government witnesses or supply information to the government. And I see it, there's different circumstances for each. They aren't all the same.
No, it's like a fingerprint, Dennis. Everybody's situation is different, you know. And, you know, Frank is right about that one thing, that, you know, guys that are considered informants are guys that are usually still in the street. They're usually still within working crews in the street doing their dirt, and they're leaking information as they go. And believe that. Right now as we speak, there's guys in the New York mob, Chicago mob, that are doing that right now as we speak. And in the future, it will come out that they were doing this from the year 2010 to 2014, 15, and you'll see. Because, you know, it's just the nature of the game. You know, it happens. But basically, you have to understand this. You know, whatever anybody's personal decision is as to why, like, me and Frank have that in common. My life was in danger as well, and, you know, the writing was on the wall, and there was no wins for me. You know, as tough as I thought I was, or, you know, I Dennis firsthand, I was involved in a lot of violence, and, you know, but there was no winning. And you realize that here you are being this loyal guy or whatever it was, and it was all going to be for nothing, and, you know, your life was expendable to these people, and the people who you consider your family are not really family. They're plotting your death. They're plotting your death, you know, as you're going through your daily activities. And it's sad. And then when you realize you're backed into this corner, and, you know, it's either eat your own arm, become what you were indoctrinated to hate, or, you know, throw your life away, you realize, hey, for once I'm going to make a decision for my own self, as opposed to making all my decisions based on how they're going to perceive me. And, you know, it's just a horrible existence anyway, you know. And just to be able to put that out there like we did in our book and in Frank's book, and, you know, and when Henry's life was shown, it's the same thing. It shows that life for what it truly is. You know, you have these childhood friendships. You have this, you know, camaraderie. You have that. But at the end of the day, those friendships are all overshadowed by the machine. And the machine won't let those friendships flourish because you can't show your loyalty to each other. You have to show your loyalty to the greater good of the machine. And that's organized crime, the bosses and everything like that. And it becomes sad. You know, guys, you know, 30 years, all of a sudden, you know, you hung out together, you went on dates together, you did X, Y, and Z together, you know, each other's families, and then they will as soon as kill you in a second just so that they could prove to the boss that they're loyal to him or work their way up the ladder for a higher position or a bigger, you know, way to earn. You know, it's very sad. You know, and, you know, it's not that all, one for all thing that we were, you know, brainwashed a believer was.
Yeah, Cam, do you have any thoughts? You know, you're in my position as an outsider. What was or is your perception of mobsters who become government witnesses or under the term, as Andrew described, their activities as informants? Do you have any opinion?
Well, I always looked at it as them being informants until I just heard your story of what Frank said. And I was like, wow, that totally makes sense. They're government witnesses. They have no choice, like Andrew said. There's no choice. They're not really your family. They don't take care of your wife and your children when you are in prison. And you just opened my eyes to something there, Denny and Andrew, that I hadn't even considered before. That is so true. And he didn't wear a wire. And he, you know, like Frank was saying, and it's just really opened my eyes.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes let me tell you what comes to my mind when I hear. I remember a few years ago we were doing an event at the Clark County Library in Las Vegas. Henry was on the panel, and I was on the panel, and some other people. And somebody either from the audience or somebody stuck their head in the door to the theater that we were in and hollered out to Henry. Henry was talking and hollered out, "Rat."
Mm.
And then took off. And, you know, the question, and I don't know the answer, but if that individual would have stayed or hung around and I could have talked with him, I would like to have said, you know, put yourself in the situation Henry was mm-hmm. in. He knows, he's heard the tapes, that he's gonna die. They're going to kill him. I'm talking about the mob. What should he have done? What would you do in his situation? Would you call the guys that are going to bump you off and say, "Hey, look, I don't want you guys to go through any extra trouble. If it's okay with you, let me know where you're going to bury me. I'll meet you out there. You know,
yeah.
I'll put a couple of behind my ear, and then you're good to go. If you want, I'll bring a shovel and even dig my own hole." So I don't really know, and I can't imagine being in that situation, but I think the instinct for survival,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when they decide they're going to kill you and you've heard the proof of that, at that point, what is your loyalty to them, to your crewmates?
You're going to want to try to save your life.
That would be
Well, you know, it's not only that, but nor it is, Dennis, like that guy who made the comment to Henry. It's like you get people who just talk out of stupidity, ignorance. You know, these people have no idea what surrounded your circumstances, what surrounded what you had to go through, what surrounded your immediate problems or what you were faced with during that time period. Now, I was incarcerated in my life. I had more friends in prison than on the street. But it wasn't about doing the jail time when I was faced with my scenarios. My scenario was, yeah, I'll do this jail time. I'll throw myself in front of the fire to protect my friends. And meanwhile, the first great opportunity they have to kill me, they're going to kill me anyway. So it's like your loyalty doesn't buy that free passage that everybody thinks about. And then they talk about, you know, respect and honor. That's all Hollywood. There is no respect and honor in organized crime circles at all, whatsoever. It's all about the money you could bring in, and that's it. You're as good as your last favor, no more, no less. Okay? Today, you're flavor of the week because you're doing good. Tomorrow, when things are bad, listen, you could do 100 great things in organized crime settings within your crew. Do 1,000 good things. Do one bad thing and see what happens. It won't matter one bit.
Now, Andrew, let me say this, and I don't want to answer. I think I know what your answer is, but I'll let you answer for yourself. I want to go back to Frank Collada for a minute. And also Henry, because, you know, what Henry told me and how he was portrayed in the movie, when it was decision time for him, when he knew the end was in sight if he didn't do something, that he wasn't going to be with us much longer. And Frank told me this, Frank Collada. He said, "The decision I made to turn, to flip, was the hardest decision I ever made," because he said, "I had been brought up on the streets, and my whole life I was told that you never, ever, the loyalty is there forever, and if you got to do life in prison without parole. Will you do that? And you smile about it before you give up your friends. He said, and suddenly that was all out the window. And he said he even contemplated suicide for a while because it was that difficult a decision. And I believe you were in a similar situation. That was not an easy decision either when you were faced with that.
No, I mean, you know, you got to understand something, Dennis. You don't wake up in the morning and decide to turn on the only life that you know. You just don't do that. Especially when you've been, you know, positive reinforced your whole life that this was something that you should never, ever do. You know, so, you know, it was like, just like the air you're breathing, that's how natural that reaction was with guys like me, friends of mine, or whatever. But when you realize this is what you're faced with, and you realize that there is no honor and nobody cares about you, and they're not loyal to you, and now all of a sudden now you have to be like, what? You're going to go and you're going to be this honorable figure, or just throw your life away, totally go out a blaze of glory, be a five-minute conversation in a bar somewhere that you had balls? I mean, come on, Dennis, truly. I mean, it doesn't take a man to pull a trigger, you know, but it takes a guy, you know, me and Billy spoke about it time and time again, you know, a guy who's down, you pull him up and you help him, that's a man, you know, but the thing is that people always get it misconstrued because they watch too much TV, they don't see it for what it is. Let me tell you something. You take 9 out of 10 guys and you put them in that position when they realize that they have no friends, they're alienated, they're a man without an island, they know that they're fighting an uphill battle, there is no wins, because, yeah, you can go out in a blaze of glory, you'll get one opportunity, and then you're done. Oh, so that makes you that don't make you a real man to throw your life away. That we throw your life away. Wow, for these people, they didn't care about you to begin with. So why? So, you know, it's like loyalty. Oh, where's his loyalty? Where's my loyalty? I put my life on the line every day in the street. I was there. I would have died for these people. I would have died for my immediate boss and my friends, and they know it. The part is that, what, at least now it's on my terms. You know, if I'm going to throw my life away, it's going to be me who do it. You're not going to be the one to do it. And for what? For nothing? Over money? Guys were getting killed over money. Not for even things that they did bad. You know how bad that makes you feel to know that the people you love the most were plotting to kill you? It's almost sickening, you know? So, yeah, it was very hard to make that decision. Very hard. You woke up one day, you hated yourself. You woke up the next, you think you did the right thing. You woke up the next, you didn't know who you were. Because now, who are you? You've been this one person your whole life. Who am I now? Who the hell am I? You know? And, you know, it's heartbreaking. It destroys, organized crime destroys everything it touches. No matter whether you stand up, whether you cooperate, no matter what it is, there's no happy ending for the guy who everybody talks good about, nor the guy that everybody looks down upon. You're all affected, and it's all negative, every bit of it.
And Andrew, I believe it's true, but you can answer this. You know, people think, in other words, people who aren't involved or never been involved in what we call the life, and have, you know, a normal life, we think of our friends as our friends, and we don't look at them with suspicion. In other words, in the mob, if I'm correct, a lot of times the person who takes you out is somebody you would think of as your friend. Somebody maybe you went to school with, you grew up with, the same neighborhood you've been in the crew with for years or whatever, and they might be the guy when the bosses decide it's your turn to go that they're going to assign to do the job.
Well, that goes back to what I told you a few minutes ago about you have been best friends for 30 years, but our loyalty can't be to each other, and the bosses will make sure that it's not. And that's what they do. They pit guys against each other so that when the time comes to do that bad deed, that you'll have the fuel in your tank to do so. So, you know, that's what they do. They manipulate situations and people. And, that's the way it's done. And that's how they rock you to sleep. Because now you're figuring you're going to get in the car with your friend. You know the guy, 35 years. And here's a guy, you know, he just seen your son in the driveway, you know, patted your son on your head, gave him $10 in his pocket, and going to go in the car with him now. And now, as he drives away, no sooner than he finished showing an act of kindness to your child, he's going to kill you when he turns the corner in the car. That's organized crime.
Yeah, and you know, Andrew, this whole scenario, like what we've just been talking about the last few minutes, is so alien to most people. that I think it's hard for a lot of us to get a grip or to get our heads around what it must be like to live under those conditions. It's so different.
Culture. You know, we followed our own rules, our own regulations. And the funny thing is that the only guys who followed the rules were the guys that weren't strong enough to break them and the guys that weren't in the position of power. If you notice, all the guys that were in a position of power, they all broke the rules and got away with it. Oh, don't deal drugs. Oh, all right. That one went out the window. Every crew in the city dealt drugs. And they all did it underneath the disguise that, well, we're shaking this guy down. We're not dealing the drugs. We're shaking him down. He's a drug dealer from the neighborhood. We're just taking the money from him. That's how they disguised that. You know? And, you know, they have all these different little set of rules. It's, you know, it's a government within the government. You know, they run their own. They got bosses on the bosses, you know, people to carry out the orders. You know, they have sit downs so they could discuss what the penalties are for certain infractions or, you know, one guy against another from a different crew or even within the family, stuff like that. I mean, years ago, when you think about the process, it worked really well in Italy because in Sicily and in Italy, you know, they were, conquered so many different times for so many other different countries and governments that the Italian men got together and they developed the mafia because they couldn't trust nobody else. They couldn't trust the governments that were in power, and the people couldn't trust them, so they trusted one another, and that's how they did it. That's what the mob was. The mob settled disputes amongst the people that from the towns that they trusted and made sure everybody treated each other fairly. It only got really distorted when it started to hit the United States really hard, and these guys started to come here and, you know, seeing that it was an easy way to make money, certain things, and, you know, and they were preying on their own kind, you know, with a black hand, preying on, you know, the immigrants who would come in from Italy to New York or throughout the country, and they're preying on their own kind. And you know what, Dennis, I was part of it for a very long time, and I can't even say not one thing I can remember ever being proud of, especially knowing that here I was thinking I was this honorable guy, a part of this society that, wow, everybody else, you know, should look at us like, you know, with all of this, you know, rose-colored sunglasses, like we had the key to the city. But meanwhile, when I started to realize after so many years what it was really about, it was really, really sad to realize that I wasn't that figure. To know that I woke up in my jail cell and I'm brushing my teeth, looking in the mirror, knowing that I'm just an outright criminal. That's all it is. There's no honor amongst it. There's no fantasy about it. I'm a criminal, plain and simple, you know. And Hollywood does that, you know. They have to show that. And those are those brainwashing techniques, Dennis. You know, kids,
yeah.
You're doing an honorable thing. You know, you're part of something that's been, you know, it's been in our, you know, generations, our family here, you know, Italian people, we're keeping this together, you know, we only trust one another, but no, those are only to get you to believe you're a part of this so that it'd be easy for you to go out and do the dirt that you got to do, you know.
Part of the brainwash. Kim, go ahead.
Denny, we got two callers on the line, and I'm going to bring them on for us. The first one is Fran from Chicago.
Okay.
Hey, you guys
ahead,
doing? Friend. Hey, you guys, how you doing?
Hey, friend.
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. I was listening to you guys talking about this whole thing with, you know, informants and people turning and stuff, and I just kind of wanted to weigh in my two cents for whatever it was worth. You know, I totally think that there's a big difference between an informant and a rat. Two different things. Just because someone's an informant, I don't think automatically puts them in a classification as, you know, the quote-unquote rat status. When somebody gives their life and then they find out that the people that they've dedicated their life to is now making it a priority because they want to cause harm to you or to your families, well, then you're in a situation where you have to examine where you are. And, you know, I learned this firsthand with my husband's family. You know, his cousin was a prominent figure who was an enforcer who, you know, did hits, did whatever, you know, was asked of him. And the FBI had bugs, and they had heard the boss saying, okay, well, it's time to whack him now. And he had no choice, you know, at that point, to watch his own back. His life was in jeopardy, his family's life, his kids' life, and he didn't feel safe. And unfortunately, now it's a situation of this happened when my husband was 8 years old. He's 35 now, and he hasn't, you know, he's gone. He's in witness protection, never to be seen from again, you know. So it's not a glorious thing when people make these decisions, in my opinion. I think that you become a product of your environment, you know. If you're in the porn industry, sex becomes something that's very accustomed to you. So people that aren't into that, you know, look at that badly, you know, or whatever the situation is. And I think, like you were saying, Andrew, that when you woke up in the cell brushing your teeth, you know, you finally see something in a different light because you're removed from the immediate situation. And it's almost like you're an outsider looking in. And it's like, wait, this isn't right. And I think that for people like you or like Henry or Frank or my husband's cousin or anybody else that has made that decision, I think takes huge courage. You know what I mean? It's not something where it's a grandstand. And I think that people follow that Hollywood stigma, you know, that they think, oh, well, this and this. You know, I've seen so many things in light of Henry's death of, oh, the guy was a murderer, the guy was this, the guy was that. I mean, I followed, you know, mafia memorabilia and things for years. I've never heard of him ever committing a murder. I could be wrong. Obviously, I don't, you know the guy personally. But to my knowledge, it's never happened. It's Hollywood portraying things and people just assuming things. And I think the thing that kind of is humorous is the ones that flap their gums and badmouth that are probably the ones that are going out and buying every single mob movie and everything else and lining pockets and then trying to act like, oh, well, it's a bad thing when they're trying to mimic it themselves. Do you know what I mean?
I could say it like this to you. You know, organized crime is the way that it was brought to the public's eye is not that kind of organized crime today when you talk about traditional organized crime, you know, Italian mafia or whatever. It's not the same. It's very far removed than what it used to be or what people thought it was. And it was very far removed as to the way I was brought up to believe it. And I've learned that firsthand being in the street and watching it. I think I said this, you know, years ago, Dennis. I remember saying that I remember going to prison in the late 80s. And when I came home, I felt like an alien. It was so different. There was no more one for all for one. You've seen the changes. You've seen the selfishness. You've seen, you know, the guys just looking to make a buck. You've seen good men getting killed over nothing, over absolutely nothing, because the boss wanted their money, because the boss wanted to teach his guy a lesson, or a guy got on a power surge, or this, that, and all of your efforts to be a dedicated guy, or, you know, a good crew member, you know, a good friend to your crew, or, you know, a guy that they could call on, you know, or something like that, because, you know, you were raised in this environment, and this is who you were, and now you're realizing that they're just using you now. There's no more caring about your outcome or what happens to you or your family or whatever. You know, look at what happens. You know, here, I give one instance. There was a guy in the crew. They took away his urn. They took his position away from him. They knew he was going to be facing a life sentence. They took this all away from him beforehand, and then when he cooperated, they wanted to know why. How could he betray us? Well, let's see. Maybe they should work on some people skills before you decide to, you know, strip a guy of everything that he has only because you want to take his money and you take his position away from him. Hey, listen, it's a double-edged sword, because then you get the other side saying, yeah, well, you knew the rules, and you know, yeah, we never changed the rules. We always followed the rules. The bosses changed the rules. They changed the rules when guys were getting killed over nothing, but, you know, I had, you know, bosses thinking, well, he knows too much, he's got to go. He's making too much money, he's probably not kicking into us, kill him. We'll take over his operation and we'll move on. A lot of that shit happened. And, you know, and the guys are seeing it for what it is now. Dennis, you know, you have to understand something. When Henry became a witness, there wasn't a lot of witnesses, but Henry opened up that door. You know, when he let people see certain things, just like, you know, there was a lot of witnesses before that. And you realize, you know, thinking about it over the years, you know, he opened people's eyes to what it was really about. And then when I've seen it, you know, of course, I didn't believe it when I first heard it, but I had to go and, you know, like anybody else, I had to get trial by fire. And then I had to live that life, and nobody could tell me different. I was this kid who was, you know, blind loyal to my friends and my crew, and that was it. And I learned trial by fire that he was right. That at the end of the day, these people do not care one iota about your family, my wife, my kids, what you do, whatever. You go rot in a prison cell, we don't care. Oh, he's a great guy. Yeah, he's a great guy. He's, you know, and exactly, you know.
I remember one time you did an interview, Andrew, and I think the one of the most prominent things I ever heard you say was that the mob and the truth can't exist in the same room together.
It's the truth.
And
you
that,
know, and the biggest ammunition they have is that we're liars. You know, you're a liar. Wait a minute. There's no lying here. You're just upset at the fact that I'm revealing the truth. So your only defense is to say liar. You know, that's your only defense. But meanwhile, you know, I remember on one of my cases, Dennis, they called me a liar for 3 or 4 years. And then all of a sudden, somebody pled guilty to the murders I said that they were involved in. And then guess what, Dennis? I guess I wasn't lying, because unless you have a mental, you know, deficiency, or are you going to, you know, take a charge of murder that you didn't commit?
Wow.
You know, so
yeah.
Basically, you know, that's how I see it, you know, and the truth of the matter is that that's another thing. When they want to point a finger at the guy's rash, they never take responsibility for their own actions. You know, maybe you shouldn't have went out and tried to kill your best friend. Maybe you wouldn't be in the position you are. Take a little, you know, take a little responsibility for your actions and start, you know, see, it, in their eyes, it's like you're a rat because you didn't let them get away with ruining your life or killing you or stuff like that. But,
right.
You know, there's an old saying in my neighborhood, Dennis. It's accepted behavior to kill your best friend, but don't you ever tell on him. Now, tell me, now, if that mentality is not warped, I don't know what is. Now, of course, you know, I'm sure there's people out there that agree and there's people out there that don't. But most of the people who don't really don't know the life anyway. They just know what people are telling them. You know, they got a friend who knows a friend who's got a buddy, whatever, and so on and so forth. And basically the final outcome of everything is that it's a very sad existence. It really is. It's a sad existence, like I told you. The most successful organized crime guy in the country is only spending $100 a week in the commissary. And he's in jail for the rest of his life. And that's the most successful guy.
That's true.
Fran.
Yes.
Thank you very much for calling. We're going to put this other caller on, I think,
thank
for a second.
You
want to hang on the line? Or okay, Kim.
All right. Thanks a lot, you guys. Have a good night.
Thanks,
Fran.
Denny, actually... Okay, our caller is back. Here he is. And this is...
This is Mike from Canada calling.
Mike
from How you doing,
Canada.
Denny and Andrew?
Hi, Mike. How are you, Mike?
Well, pretty good. Good. I guess still in shock of my friend Henry passing on, but he was one of the last of the old-time gangster-type characters, and I'm very happy for a couple of things that he did introduce me to you, Denny. And through you, I got introduced to Andrew and some of the other boys. And I did get to see Henry for the last time in Las Vegas just a couple months ago. So I was, I guess I was pretty pleased about that. And I just wanted to share a couple of my favorite Henry Hill stories, if that's okay with you guys.
That, go ahead.
That Henry had told me on, I guess I got to know Henry in the last 3 years. I was down in Los Angeles, and I spent a whole day with him all around. He toured me around and down to Venice Beach and all over the place. And usually about 3 or 4 times a month on the phone and stuff. And so I was asking him a lot of questions. And Henry was, as you would know, was pretty comical at times. He'd come up with some kind of funny stories there. And when you wouldn't think it'd be a funny situation, but I asked him, I guess, out of the movie, the couple scenes in the movie where. In the part where they killed Spider down in the lounge there when they were playing cards and everything. I asked him what that was like. But basically he was telling me that Tommy Dean Simone was nothing but a homicidal maniac to begin with, and he would just kill anybody for any reason. But when I asked him what it was a scene like, Henry's first response was, "Holy cow," he said. "I couldn't hear nothing for 3 days," he said, because of the gunshots and the low ceiling. And, you know, I figured he would tell me a little more, but he'd start off with that. You know, he's just saying, like, I couldn't hear a darn thing for over 3 days. He said that low ceilings and that thing and the guns going off and, oh, what a mess, he said, that poor kid. So basically we're talking a little bit about that. And I guess another very interesting conversation later on, almost the last in the movie, where we met Jimmy Burke for the last time in that diner. And that actually did take place. That was true, that he had met him in a diner. And Jimmy was telling him to go down, I'm not sure whether it was Florida or not, but it was someplace to do a hit. And, you know, as Andrew was saying, these guys still pretend to be your friends, and, you know, and how are things going? We'll get you out of this mess, Henry. And, you know, in the meantime, they're plotting to kill the guy, eh? To set him up any way they can, and still trying to believe that you're your friends and everything. And I asked Henry, I said, did you knew right away what was going to happen? He said, yeah, I knew right away when Jimmy started acting strange and, you know, asking me to go on to do a hit with somebody. And I've never been, I've been there lots of times when people were murdered, but I never murdered anybody, and I want people to know that. And Jimmy was asking me to go. And then he was telling me he could get me out of this mess I was in and everything. And I said, did he know that you knew that it was a setup? He said, God, no. He said, if he would known that I had any idea what was going to happen, I don't think I would have made it out of Queens alive. And if he really thought it was an emergency, he said, he would have whacked me right in the parking lot of that diner. You know, he said, I wouldn't even made it to the car, he said, if he would have thought. And then after that, things started happening real fast with the FBI and everything like that. Later on, about 2 or 3 hours after that meeting, things started really, with Ed McDonald and everything, started moving pretty quick for Henry. And, you know, I guess the rest would be history, I guess.
Yes.
Without a doubt, history. You know, Henry was, you know, he was well-known, Henry. I mean, you know, it's so weird that, you know, when you think about it, you know, here he was. He was a mob associate, but he had such a following, and he had so many, you know, let's face it, he was in the thick of things for a long time. And, you know, his following, if you think about it, Dennis, you know, I was talking, I think, with Frank about it the other day, and we were talking about it, and said, you know, it's a shame that, you know, you had to view these things in Henry's passing, you know, but this guy was more popular than John Gotti. I mean, really. I mean, you know, because when you think of organized crime, those are the names that come to mind. But meanwhile, I'll tell you the truth. You know, Henry's name, everybody knows. And, you know, everybody recites, like Mike was just saying on the phone, everybody recites things from the movie, you know, things that Henry said. And this, and it's amazing. It really is amazing. He left a learning lesson on the public. I mean, people are going to be reading his books and watching his movies forever.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, he was immortalized with the movie, and he was such a great guy. We had a couple years ago at Christmas time on Boxing Day, I had a Goodfellas party at my house here I live on the east coast of Canada, and I had it all set up with Henry before, and there was about 12 people here, I guess, 12, 14 people. And I called Henry out right after the showing of it, and he answered everybody's questions. He took the time out, and they said hello to him, and they answered everybody's questions, and he sent up some of the mobster art that he had, and signed them for everybody and everything like that. So he was a really a great guy, and even talked to my wife, and my wife was kind of skeptical about it because you gentlemen had a pleasure of meeting her in Las Vegas there, and she was very impressed with Henry, the way he talked, and he says, as long as people know that I'm not the man I used to be. And, you know, she was quite impressed, you know, the way he was explaining things. He said,
and,
you know, I did.
And that's the best way to do it, Mike, see, because that's the whole idea is, like, when you do cooperate with the government and you're really putting your best foot forward to change your life and walk away from that life, you know, you can't just do it with your mouth. You got to go and do it with deed. You know, you got to go out there. You have to speak to people. You have to, you know, try to educate. You know, we're not teachers or anything like that, but you want to open people's eyes to what it, you know, what's really, really like. And Henry did that. You know, we all do that every day. You know, we try. And, you know, that's the biggest plus out of everything is letting people learn from our lives. We have friends who lost their lives way before their time, who can't teach somebody something. We were fortunate to be alive and make it out alive, so it's almost something like a gift you can give somebody to let them see that there's no heroes in organized crime. There's no, you know, there's not these higher than, you know, godly figures, guys who carry themselves with such, you know, respect, and it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, that's the best way to, you know, just to dissect it, let people see what it is. And, you know, we got a second chance in life, every one of us, you know. And so it's almost like you need to let people see that. You were fortunate enough to survive it. Let them see it. You know, you're going to get, of course, people who don't believe it, you know, people who have a different opinion, and that's fine. But you'll see how, you know what, Dennis, the funny thing is that everybody has something to say about a guy who cooperates until it's their mother or father who was missing, who they're trying to get closure to, or this, that, or the other thing. And then all of a sudden, that witness is somebody they look on with a set of different eyes. It's when people actually see what organized crime truly does to people. And, you know, in the movies and stuff like that, you know, at the end of the day, these people go home. But in real life, you can't wipe that blood off and move on. You know, people cry real tears. You know, people's lives are ruined every day between organized crime, violence, and stuff like that. And you can't control that either. You know, all the collateral damage. I mean, you can't control it. You know, and that's another thing that people don't understand. You know, you think, oh, they only kill one another. That's not true. You know, people get caught in the middle of it every day, and it's still happening today.
And I think with you and Denny and Billy and yourself getting the word out, people are taking your word for what it is, which is the truth. And I think you're getting through to a lot of people. You know, you have a big following now, and through the books and the media. I think a lot of people are following, and the people that aren't are either fools or they're in Hollywood still, you know, watching the movies. And, there's no winners in the mafia, nobody.
No, but see, it's the shame of it all is, Mike, is that in my neighborhood, there's kids there still, you know, who believe in that system, you know, and they believe it, you know. It's like, this is, you know, Fran said something earlier. She said that, you know, you're a product of your environment. So in my neighborhood, these were the guys that we looked up to growing up. These are the guys that who we wanted to be around. These are the guys that, you know, we wanted to emulate ourselves from. And, you know, these were our idols. These were the people we wanted to be like, be around. And, you know, and we only seen the brightest side of it. We never got to see them at their worst. We never got to see them, you know, with their dark side of how they really treat people. Or, you know, nobody's talking about, listen, in 20 years from now, you guys, you know, you're playing stickball today, but in 20 years, I want to have you kill him, and then me and you, we're going to, you know, you don't think of these things. You know, you're just a young kid with, you know, big eyes and ambition. And that's what they, you know, that's what some of the bosses prey on, young kids who they could, you know, direct in the direction to, you know, do their dirty work and stuff like that. And then once you learn the rules, it's too late, because now you know, when your eyes are open, that's when it really hurts. You know that your whole life was a lie, you know?
Yeah, it's almost too late at that point there, you know, once that happens.
Exactly.
Andrew, let me, you know, Michael, of course, is a friend of ours, and I just want to mention, this is probably a good time to do it, that tomorrow night, Mike, we're going to have a program on the same time on Blog Talk Radio. It's called We Know a Guy, and it's a part of the slogan from Bear Media. It was formerly known as the Real Wise Guy Show, and our guests tomorrow night are going to be a person you know, Billy Cotolo Jr., and also, have you ever heard of Greg Scarpa?
Yes, I have, yeah, very much so. I just
His daughter Linda is going to be a co-guest.
Oh, is that okay? I just saw a clip on him on one of the, it was on the one of the channels there. They had Yeah, I just forget what it was. But they had his daughter on there talking about it. I guess different.
Well, she's gonna be a guest tomorrow night. So to tune in with us tomorrow night too, and we'll be talking some more MAP. And Andrew, have you got aware of some things coming up on the Discovery Channel you'd like to mention?
Well, on the Discovery Channel, yes, Dennis. I'm happy to say this. There's starting on the 25th, Discovery Channel, 9 p.m. I did the first episode of Mobster Confessions. Billy Cotolo, I believe, is going to be the first episode. I believe Billy's episode is coming out on June 25th, 9 p.m. And I believe the second episode is half-hour segments. And I believe the second hour is going to be Frank Calabrese from Chicago. So that's the first night. And then every Monday after that, for the next 3 weeks following, there'll be two segments a night every Monday. And I believe the second week will be Frank Collada and a gentleman by the name of Peretti, I believe his name was, from I don't want to mess his name up. I can't remember it, but he was from Philadelphia. Yeah, Ron Peretti, I think it was. Peretti, something like that. He's got a very interesting story, too. I was reading about it earlier today, and that should be a great show. And I believe that the last show is going to be my show, and I believe that's on July 9th, I believe. That's going to be the last show. Me and a gentleman named John Vesey. John Vesey, I believe, I don't know if he's going to be on at 9 or I'm going to be at 9:30. I don't know what the exact schedule is, but it's going to be really good shows. Everybody did really, really good work. And it's just they do, you know, little tidbits about guys' lives and, you know, each one of us, you know, has a story to share. And hopefully, you know, we can, you know, people that don't really know about organized crime, maybe it'll be a night where they could watch and learn something, you know.
And Andrew, what is the name of the show again?
Mobster Confessions.
Mobster Confessions on Discovery Channel. Excellent. Thank you.
And Mike?
Yes, Denny?
Before we move on, I got a little special treat for you.
Okay.
If you tune in, and assuming the schedule is right, and Billy Cotolo is going to be on, Billy's episode will be on either the first or second segment this coming Monday, unless I get edited out, I'm going to be in it too. So you'll get to see me.
Okay, all right.
I mean, does it get any better than that?
That'll be cool. And
Dennis is making his Hollywood debut.
And
of course, I might have been left on the cutting room floor, but we'll find out Monday.
I guess before I let you go there, I just want to say one more quick thing that I'm glad I made Henry happy, because a week before I met him in Las Vegas, he had asked me to bring down 5 sober dollars for his grandchildren, Canadian sober dollars. So I'd given him a couple in Los Angeles there a couple years ago, and I brought them down and I gave them to him in the mob bar. After the festivity was over, he was actually, I gave them to him at the museum, and later on I asked, he still got those, Henry? He had them right in his pocket. They were going right to his grandchildren. So I'm glad that I made the final thing happy for Henry there. So I was,
well,
we were pleased.
Beautiful, Mike. That's a good story, Mike. Thank you.
All right, you guys have a good evening, and we'll tune in tomorrow with. It's tomorrow night, is it? On
tomorrow night, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, East Coast Time.
All right, we'll tune in tomorrow. Have a good evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for calling.
You get.
Right. Andrew, the time's going by real quick. I have only gotten to really to one of the questions I wanted to raise, so let me do this real quick. I wanted to let people know, the listeners, a little bit about witness protection, okay? I think there are some misconceptions about it. Some people, I think, are under the impression you go into witness protection, you're kind of set up in a luxury penthouse somewhere, all the taxpayer expense, and but you know, whatever you want is yours. You never have to worry about working or earning money. You're on the government's dime. But that isn't really the way witness protection runs, is it?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it's a necessary evil so that, you know, you and your family can be protected from, you know, violence or anything like that. And but like anything else, they just put you in a place where, you know, nobody would know you, you know, and they'll keep you safe. And I have nothing but the highest regard for the Marshal Service. The Marshal Service protected me and my family for a long time. And, you know, they put me in a place where you know, here's your places where you guys are going to be. You know, now go out and, you know, reinvent yourself. This is, you know, go out there, go to work. And that's what I did. I went out there and went to work. And it's second chance in life, Dennis. And like anything else, whatever you make of that chance, that's what's going to happen. Some guys, they fall off the horse, and it's sad to say, and it doesn't work out for them. Certain guys, they thrive and they get lucky because you need to, you know, you get lucky as well. And those guys make the best of it. I was blessed enough that I made the best of it. And, you know, but it's working. Nobody give you nothing for free. There's nothing. There's no free ride here. They'll be the first ones to kick you to the curb if you would act as though you think you got something coming like that. You know, they'll put you in a place. They'll let you, you know, whatever skills you have or whatever. They might even help you say, well, there's a place here or there that you can go and look for work. They'll point you in a direction, but they're not going to hold your hand, you know, especially if you're a man. You know, you're a man. You got to go and act like a man. Go do what you have to do. And, you know, basically that's it. You know, that misconception happens a lot because in their mind, you know, that's what people want them to believe. So it fuels the fire for them to hate you because of that. He sold out his friends. Now he's going to go live in the witness program and he's going to get everything he wants. And it doesn't work that way. You know, nobody's story, you know, is like this, you know, this, how can I say it? This fairy tale ending. You got to go out and you got to make a living and work and tell them to go out and try and doing that without being able to prove a background check or anything like that. Or even if you had a high education, you can't even prove that. You got to do everything from scratch. It's three times as hard because you got to do this with no background, with nobody to put on your resume to say that you were X, Y, and Z. You got to do this on your own. And some guys are capable of doing it, and I'm sad to say other guys ain't. It's that's one of the reasons why we started, you know, helping guys who were getting out of prison and, you know, trying to help them. You know, they're living in parts unknown, don't know anybody. We were looking to, you know, extend the olive branch and say, listen, if you need help trying to get on your feet or work, maybe we can help you do something. You know, we give back to the communities all around the country and we'll get you on board or whatever, because we know how hard it can be. You know, it's no easy ride. It's not.
And isn't it true, Andrew, that, you know, what contrary to what people might think, is not only don't you live the life of luxury, in fact, you get a new identity, yeah, but you don't have, I mean, it isn't like maybe a CIA guy or something going on with some big cover story, you know, where they have a whole life recreated for them. You got to go in and apply for a job, and you got no credit history. You know, you're 35, 40, maybe 50 years old, depending on the individual, and no employment history and stuff. I mean, that's got to be tough to try to convince an employer.
It's very tough, and that's why, you know, we try to help, you know, we try to help guys, you know, get on their feet and try to help them to get work and stuff like that. You know, we try to do things like that because we know that if you've got a family to take care of, you know, you could easily fall off the horse. And let's face it, when you're around crime your whole life, and then you can't do anything else. Sometimes people think in their mind that they can't do anything else. You know, you want to reestablish them. You know, you want to give them the confidence and let them know, yeah, you can change. You can do these things. You know, you're not alone. There's a whole network of guys out here that will help you to get through it because it does get tough. It really does, you know. And people need to see the whole picture. You know, but like I said, those stories are fueled by people who've got hatred for you, for what you've done, to cooperate and everything like that. So they want people to believe that, you know, you did this so, you know, your life is going to be this cushy life. But you could have a cushy life, but you're going to have to work for it night and day like everybody else.
Got to earn it. Andrew, we've run out of time. Gee, thanks a million for being on with us, and the hour certainly went by fast.
It was a pleasure, Dennis. It was always a pleasure. Kim, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Andrew. Likewise.
All right. You guys have a good night. I'll speak to you guys soon. Good night.
And thanks to the Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, June 26th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice. Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you'd like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website, www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. And don't forget to keep Susan in your prayers. Good night, everyone.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Kim. Good night.
Thank you. Good night, Andrew. Good night, Denny.